I am a senior fellow at the Center of International Cooperation and a weekly columnist for foreignpolicy.com. And this is the first of what we hope and believe will be a series of panels by the Center of International Cooperation. And so we're very delighted to be beginning with what I think will be a very distinguished and interesting discussion. We'll have further topics over time. So just to give you an idea of how the panel will work, each of our three panelists, whom I will introduce in a moment, will speak for perhaps 8 or 10 minutes. Then we will have a discussion amongst the four of us, and then we'll throw it open to questions for everyone. So I just want to say just something briefly about the subject, nurturing democracy in the Arab world. What can outsiders do? I think the fact that we're having this conversation now, as opposed to 6 months ago or a year ago, means that it's a much more fraught conversation than it might have been. The sense of euphoria that many of us had a year ago, a sense that probably at that time was hyperbolic, has been replaced by a sense of foreboding, which I think perhaps also is a little bit hyperbolic. But what it's led to, I think, is an almost despairing sense about what it is outsiders can do. That sense, I think, caused by a couple of different things. One is the apparent stalling of the Arab Spring itself. That is to say, the three countries that have succeeded in overthrowing their leader are the same ones that were true 3, 6, 9, in some cases 12 months ago. So the Arab Spring has stopped expanding. Second, we're deeply aware of the profound problems in at least two of those three countries, Egypt and Libya. Tunisia remains a source of great hope. And so there's a sense of the contracting of possibilities. There's also the sense of the contracting of what it is outsiders can do. I mean, probably the grossest example is the backlash against foreign democracy promotion NGOs as well as domestic NGOs in Egypt. Gives the impression that outside assistance not only is not welcome, but indeed is exploitable by opponents of democracy. And then, of course, the terrible blockage in Syria right now is as outsiders seek to find some way of resolving that problem. So I hope that one of the things we'll be able to do today is get past that all too simple opposition between hyperbolic idealism and hyperbolic skepticism, and talk a little bit about what outsiders have been able to be successful in doing elsewhere and what they might be able to do today. So let me just briefly introduce our three panelists, and then I'm going to turn it over to them. So in the order in which they'll be speaking, our first panelist is Bruce Jones, immediately to my left, who is the director of the Center of International Cooperation. Our second panelist, Sarah Cliff, is at the UN, where she is the Secretary General, and I have to now look this up to make sure I don't get it wrong, Special Advisor on Civilian Capacity, with special reference to the World Development Report on Conflict, Security, and Development. Our last panelist, Shadi Hamid, is the Director of Research at the Doha Brookings Center, as well as a fellow at the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution. So thank you very much, and let me turn this over to
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming. It's an honor to be here, especially with these two who know a great deal more about transitions and about the Arab world than I do. But I'll say a few things about how I think it is that outside actors can and can't help what's going on right now in the Arab Spring context. I've, of course, been thinking about this heavily around the UN perspective, but I'll also range broader than the UN and talk about international actors broadly than just the UN. I'm going to start with a few things that we shouldn't do, and here I do particularly have the UN in mind over the last 12 months or so. We should not treat the transitions in the Arab Spring as somehow a continuation of a pattern of post-conflict transitions that have preoccupied much of the international community since the end of the Cold War. I think in the first days of the Arab Spring, and then in particular with Libya, there was a sense of the Arab Spring as a new round of opportunities to engage in things like special political missions and peacekeeping operations and electoral assistance and these kinds of activities that have been the bread and butter of the international community's work. Second, I think it's problematic when you see outside actors, which we've seen quite a lot of on the stage, sitting on the outside and kind of cherry-picking, having difficulty hearing in the back. If I speak into the microphone more like that, is that better? No. We need mic assistance. Seems to be on. Is that better? Okay, sorry. So I won't repeat. I was just saying, don't treat the Arab Spring like a continuation of the transitions that we've been focusing on during much of the post-Cold War era. I think these are of a very different character in terms of the kinds of countries that we're engaging with here and what's required. The second thing I think is worrying is when we see the international community as a whole sort of cherry-picking on who knows what basis. This regime is now illegitimate and should go. Let's not focus so much on Bahrain. These guys should leave now. We're not really going to talk about Saudi. This kind of stuff, I think, is unhelpful, to say the least. I think there needs to be a stronger normative grounding for what it is that the international system thinks about and tries to act on in the Arab Spring context, and I'll come to that in one moment. The last point to make, though, of course, is that in a sense, contrary to that, is to not treat the Arab Spring as if it's a model of the Cold. These are very different countries. I mean, Yemen has almost nothing to do with Egypt, which has almost nothing to do with Libya. I mean, these are very different context, and we have to have that nuance in the discussion. If I think about the normative grounding and the narrative of what's happening, I think there is an important shift that needs to occur. And here I think the UN is actually surprisingly well positioned to help. And that is, despite the title that we gave this panel, we called it Nurturing Democracy, but I actually think that democracy is not a broad enough concept to use to discuss what's happening in the Arab Spring. And I actually think that the UN's articulation of the rule of law, which in other parts of the world I'm quite critical of, in the Arab Spring context, I think provides a very useful normative framework and a narrative for what's going on. And the UN has a strong grounding here. If we go back to the work that UNDP did in the Arab Human Development Report, sort of well before the beginning of the Arab Spring, almost 10 years ago at this stage, looking at democratic deficits in the Arab world, looking at other kinds of deficits in the Arab world, and laying out a case for change. Kofi Annan made similar arguments to the Arab League and to the Organization of the Islamic Conference in the early part of this decade, the previous decade. So there's kind of narrative tradition that has not at all been followed up politically or operationally or by the development actors in the UN. Let's be clear about that. There is a normative platform here. And I think if you look at the way the United Nations has spelled out the concept of the rule of law, it's a very encompassing concept that has four critical elements. Representative and inclusive political institutions, very important, part of the demand that citizens are making in the Arab world. Civilian control and human rights frameworks for the security services, an equally important demand in a range of cases. Economic justice, which is often left out of discussions of democratic transition, but I think is extremely important to focus on in this context. And fourth, adherence by the state to international. I think if the UN were to speak about the normative framework here and the narrative of the Arab Spring transitions, it should add a fifth component, which is the rule of the charter, so to speak, in thinking about how it is that we play out external support to these transitions, recognizing two important things, that there is a strong charter provision for non-interference, and that there also is the provision for the Security Council to overturn that provision, and those two things are equally important. But that broader framework of the rule of law, including economic justice, seems to me one that's worth emphasizing and articulating as a normative and narrative framework for what's going on and driving international assistance to a range of actors through that framework, rather than what I think we risk is a narrow democratic focus on elections and constitutions. There's been a broader panoply of political and economic institutional transformations that we need to focus on. That's number one. Number two, I mean, I already referenced economic justice, and I think that if we look at the situation across the Arab world and the nature of the demands and the nature of the economies in question, a focus on the economics here is going to matter a great deal. I think that we see, particularly in places like Egypt, the questions of redistribution become extremely important. Demand for jobs, I think Sarah will talk more about that, but the economic issues here are very important. But it's extremely hard in economic redistribution or rebalancing economic inequalities in a context of shrinking economies. That's a recipe for political failure. it's much easier to do it in the context of growing economies for obvious reasons. And so the question of whether or not we enter a period of economic contraction in the Arab world or whether we can stimulate economic growth in the Arab world becomes, I think, pretty critical to whether or not we see positive or negative outcomes. I'm shortcutting this discussion, but if you had to point to one sort of silver bullet in that, it would be access to European markets through free trade. And in the very first days of the Arab Spring, we saw some European discussion about this, whether they could sort of expand and accelerate Euromed discussions to open up to free trade with Egypt and Tunisia and other states. That's rather quickly been lost, and I think, you know, understandably, given that Europe is in the midst of the Eurozone crisis, and if you look at recent numbers, I think literally in a depression, at least in southern Europe. Though, of course, if the principles that underlay the European Union were right, then free trade should be good for them even in this circumstance. So I think that encouraging the Europeans to return to a discussion about creating the conditions for free trade with the Maghreb and with the Levant Arab countries is an extremely important part of what can help in this context, as well as in that context setting up a series of conditions for access to the market in the same way that the European Union did in the context of East European transitions after the fall of the Soviet Union. One of the great examples of peaceful transition of our time, using the conditionalities to access the European market as a way of guiding transitions in the European context. And there are, it's not a perfect analogy, but there are important analogies of how accessing the European market could work in the Maghreb and in Egypt as well. The third point that I would make at this point in time, the diplomatic sphere, is not to neglect the dogs that haven't barked or that have barked only a little bit. And here I'm thinking, of course, about Bahrain, but also Jordan and Saudi. The transitions that we've seen case of Bahrain started and squelched, in the case of Jordan, just rumblings, not much yes in Saudi. I don't know whether it's weeks or months or a couple of years before these transitions, or before the demand for transition becomes acute, but it's certainly not more than that. And I think that as an outside, or outside actors can help to be thinking about the nature of those transitions and to be pushing for democratic reform, rule of law reform in a number of those contexts before we see a kind of explosion of violence. I would include in that context, by the way, the Palestinian Authority. We have seen some murmurings of dissent in the, among Palestinian youth, but not yet a broad-based movement for change of the sort of type that we've seen in the Egypt, Tunisia, and the Palestinian context. I suspect that that's likely to come. In the international system, in the UN, this ends up getting handled strangely, too, because we're used to thinking of the PLO and the Palestinian Authority as the representatives of an occupied people, which, of course, at one level they are. It's also a highly corrupt and dysfunctional political entity. And it seems to me that we should be, as outside actors, I just see no reason why we should be seeking to shield the Palestinian Authority from the pressures for democratic change any more than we should be seeking to shield Israel from the pressure to end the occupation. And this, of course, has a particular potency in the UN context, where the Palestinian Authority has launched the drive for membership, not right now in the Council, but in other bodies. And in a number of forums, the Palestinian Authority is pretty blatant about saying that the drive for membership is in part a way of trying to convince its street not to seek sort of popular change. And it seems that there's no reason that we should be supportive of that. Getting traction on anti-occupation is vitally important, but just as important to think about the democratic transition and rule of law transition in the Palestinian context itself. I realize that would be controversial, but so. The fourth point I would make is we can't neglect the fact that a lot of these transitions will happen in other ways. And of course, here I'm thinking right now about Syria, and I'm worried about Iraq. And others will have other things to say about this. On Syria, let me briefly say, I've written about this, and we're talking about this a lot, that I think it's critically important that we try in every possible way to allow Annan's mission to succeed. I do not think that Annan's mission is primarily about convincing Assad to launch some sort of democratic reforms. I don't think that that's what's going on. I think that Annan's mission must be about laying out a detailed roadmap for how to implement the Arab League transition and creating a context in which China and Russia can come on board with the Council in implementing that in that plan. That's tricky, but not impossible. And the alternatives, I think, are much, much worse. Either military intervention or militarization of the conflict between the army and the rebels, I think, is moral position there. I'm taking a practical position. If there's any chance of Anand's mission succeeding, I think he deserves as much support as possible. I would make a similar point about diplomacy in the Iranian context. We can't pretend that the question of Iran doesn't loom over the transitions we're talking here, loom over the geopolitics. We now have a narrow window for negotiations with Iran, and it seems to me that they have to do three things. We have to have a unified pressure on Iran to give up the nuclear weapons option, and so the nuclear civilian option, the nuclear weapons option. At the same time, we shouldn't pretend that Iran doesn't have legitimate security concerns. And any credible negotiation with Iran is going to have to address those security concerns. We're going to be talking about and thinking about what a security architecture looks like that can address some of Iran's security concerns. Those are the two main things. And then I think, let's just be realistic here, the period of negotiations that will follow also gives time for Japan, China, and India to diversify supply if we end up in crisis. But I would focus on the negotiating opportunity now because the consequences of militarization of either of those two conflicts are very severe indeed. The last point that I want to make is a kind of broad normative one. It seems to me that in the sweep of human history, there are episodes that encompass enormous opportunity. When I think about the UN, for example, and where it's truly contributed to human advance, I think about the way the UN was the handmaiden to decolonization. I think about the role that the UN and other actors have played in ending civil war since the end of the Cold War. And I think Arab Spring is a similar moment. I think we have the demand of 1 billion people for liberation and human dignity. And that taking advantage of that moment and doing whatever we can to support that demand is a fundamental moment. And the UN and other outside actors should be seeking to support that in every possible way. Again, I think it's critically important to get the normative framework of that right, but not to neglect how significant a moment this is for human opportunity. So let me stop there.
Great, thanks, Bruce. Sarah?
Thank you. Is this one working? Can everyone hear it at the back? I'm going to speak personally about the experience of some of the transitions that we looked at in the World Development Report and their implications for looking at international assistance now to the states of the Middle East and North Africa. I agree first with the presumption that was in the background blurb to this event that transitions of this sort are indigenous and they're driven primarily by national dynamics. So I think it is important to start with a fairly humble viewpoint towards what role international actors play. But having said that, there are, I think, some useful lessons from other countries that have gone through very significant transitions from authoritarian rule to more open and democratic rule. The first that occurred to me when I was thinking about preparing for this panel is that transitions can come about through gradual reform and settlement as well as through rupture. So if we look at some of the best-known transitions that we would think of around the world, you have a complete rupture in a regime that was in power, as occurred, for example, in Argentina or in much of the Soviet Union. You have negotiated settlements of different sorts, whether in the South African transition, where certain entitlements and privileges for the old white population was maintained during the transition, or in Chile, where the role of the military was very gradually eroded rather than immediately through one overall change. And you also have gradual reform over time. So in Ghana in the late 80s or the 1990s, or in Indonesia after the fall of Suharto. Now, in all of those situations, it's fair, I think, to say that international assistance across a range of areas played as much of a role in the Indonesian or Ghanaian transitions as it did in the ones where there was a real rupture or sudden revolutionary change. So looking at both types of change is perhaps important when we look now at the region, particularly thinking about the pressure to reform in places like Morocco, for instance, as well as the revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, or Libya. The second is that transitions in other countries have typically been multiple. They haven't just been one process of change that took place over a one-year or three-year period, and they've occurred over quite long periods of time. So we went back and looked at the experience of the fastest 20 reformers in the 20th century on indicators like rule of law, open democratic participation, control of corruption, etc. And it took those countries between 15 and 30 years to move those indicators to a place where they were really consistently serving their people. They also typically went through some setbacks where there were periods in those transitions where it seemed that things were going in the wrong direction, and then they picked up and they went forward again. So important, I think, when we think about this, first to believe that rupture does not actually necessarily guarantee fast transition. The countries that have resolute revolutions still take quite a long time after that to put in place all the institutions that make for a state of rule of law. And second, to avoid perhaps what Jim said in his introduction about moving between euphoria and foreboding, that we should actually think that setbacks are normal in these processes. Be aware, of course, if things are really going in a very negative direction, but not take this as a reason to disengage or to give up on forward progress. The third point is that inclusive enough coalitions for change have been very important in almost all of these transitions, sometimes expressed through an explosion of civil society and political parties who were previously prevented from organizing, sometimes expressed through more structured methods for participation. One experience, I think, for instance, which is relevant to the kind of demands that might be made in the Arab Spring, is South Africa's experience of having councils for almost every area of economic and social policy during the transition. So this was very much an experience that didn't only focus on participation through voting, it focused on setting up institutions that gave people a feeling that they were input into policy and policy during a transitional period. In terms of international support, I think that that raises a couple of points. One is that international support to a range of institutions, to governments who are reforming, but also to civil society, to trade unions, to rural movements, etc., can be very important. The second, and perhaps contrarily, is to be slightly careful about the degree of financial support that is channeled to institutions. Transitions that I've just talked about, those civil society institutions or trade unions were seen very much as being national independent movements. So it was hard to accuse them, for instance, of being a tool of Western powers. Sometimes when we think about putting a lot of financial support quickly into countries that are in an early period of fragile transitions, we can create a vulnerability also to organisations being accused of that kind of link, which in itself can undermine reformers rather than strengthening reformers. The fourth point is on sustaining momentum between first delivering some actual results that make a difference in people's real lives. So, for example, in Chile or in Argentina, some phased action on justice, while it wasn't fast, but it started early in the transition, and some fast action on social protection so that people were not vulnerable from unemployment was very important in stabilising those processes. Continuing that to more systematically look at how to help transform the institutions that are most critical for sustained peace, in particular the institutions that provide security, justice and employment, is going to be crucial for those countries. That means, I think, when requested, the international community trying to move quickly and provide assistance at scale. I think that Tunisia, for instance, is facing a very difficult situation at the moment in terms of unemployment and investment. And despite all the institutional progress that has been made, that situation has some potential to cause problems in the transition if help is not provided. Their own economy may not provide that in the short term. So this is a classic role for some international help. It also means, when requested, providing assistance in some of the difficult areas. So areas of police reform, security sector reform, transitional justice, are not always areas that international donors like engaging in because they raise difficult issues of legacies of human rights abuses and corruption. If requested to do so, those can be some of the most crucial institutional transformations. Fifth point is about avoiding double standards. So the Arab Spring, I think, demonstrated the extent to which issues of human rights and corruption were not an imposition of Western values. They were things that were very deeply felt by the population problems in the countries concerned, validated, by the way, by research across country, which shows that countries that have high levels of human rights and corruption have a 45% greater chance of having conflict or civil war in future. But at the same time, quite a large part of the international community was not very engaged prior to the Arab Spring in pointing out those issues, with some notable exceptions, as Bruce referred to the Arab Human Development Report, for instance, but it wasn't necessarily the norm. So now trying to find a more consistent way to raise the fact that there are some international norm-based routes to be followed, that these are not things that come purely from outside the region, they're things that it's clear the population of the region themselves have expressed as important to them. So that brings me to the last point, which I find myself unusually in full agreement with Bruce, in fact, on one of his points, but is of the role for a possible broader initiative here on rule of law and social and economic justice. So I find that a lot of this debate has been on individual responses to individual countries, and that is important to do. It's also important to recognise that contexts differ a great deal and that things need to be adapted to the context of each country. But at the same time, there is clearly a much wider sweep of change going on here that is only encapsulated by the experience of each country. So there is, I think, a real opportunity that I'm not sure is fully being taken at the moment to look at a broader initiative that tries to help express and consolidate some of those aspirations for democratic participation, for rule of law, for social and economic justice, not only, by the way, in the Arab Spring, but also in the protests we've seen in other countries, including in this one, and use that as part of the political and developmental discourse going forward. That, I think, can include a much greater emphasis on South-South experiences and exchanges across countries, which makes it clear that there is not just one model of a state that people are working towards, but several different models and pathways. And it is, I think, something that could be taken much more into account when we discuss the international goals for development, as, for instance, in the 2015 MDGs, to recognise that people around the world have been expressing some goals in areas like justice, which have not been previously included in our international discussion, and which perhaps we should much more seriously take into account going forward.
Thank you, Sarah.
Shadi?
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll just use the pruning.
Okay, so the Obama administration often said, and this I think is one of the themes that we've heard a lot since the Arab Spring began, it's not about us, it's about them, right? And by us, I mean this context, America, Americans. It is partly about us. And I think there's a sense that we're not innocent bystanders in this current phase, because the U.S. was supporting the most autocratic regimes in the region for more than 50 years. So we were very much part of that problem. We had a certain paradigm where we privileged stability over democracy. So I think it's very disingenuous to come in post-Arab Spring and present ourselves as either neutral or pro-democracy when everyone in the region knows quite differently that we played, quite frankly, a very destructive role in the Arab world for quite a long time. So I think we as Americans, and I'm speaking now as an American, we have to kind of take a step back and I think reassess some of our assumptions, the assumptions that are guiding us during this post-Arab Spring period. I was in Egypt on February 11th last year. That was the day that Mubarak stepped down. I was in Tahrir Square. It was one of the most remarkable moments of my life, and it's very interesting to kind of contrast the euphoria of that day and where we are now. It's quite striking. But what was the chant that everyone was saying that night? You're Egyptian, raise your head up high. Now, I think it's important to remember that, because I think the assumption is that either this was about bread or freedom or some combination thereof. That's certainly true. But at the same time, it was about something broader than just that. Part of it was a desire to be free from foreign interference, the sense that the U.S., Israel, Western powers had kind of put Egypt in a box and cut it down to size to the extent where Egypt couldn't play its traditional leadership role. So I think that led to this sense of humiliation that Egyptians felt that they had been on the receiving end of history and they didn't have agency, moral or political agency. So I think part of what the Arab Spring was about Egyptians and Arabs saying, we're going to take control of our own lives. So I think that context is important so that we can just kind of take a step back and understand how Egyptians and Arabs view the role of Western powers, that we think we can come in and kind of undo the past and say, we are your friend in your struggle for freedom, that we want to have this future-oriented approach, right? But the past is still very relevant, and we're bogged down by the past. And for those of you watching, the NGO crisis, where essentially, you know, seven Americans were held hostage, and some of them in the U.S. embassy and couldn't leave. In understanding where a lot of that anti-Americanism comes from, we have to look back. Now, as much as there's this kind of anti-Americanism or opposition to foreign influence, there's another side of the Arab Spring too. And yes, these were indigenous uprisings, but I think what we've learned is that indigenous uprisings aren't enough. There have only been two examples of peaceful protests that were completely indigenous to topple a regime. Egypt and Tunisia. You could even argue that Egypt had an important international factor, right? But since then, what have we had? Libya, NATO military intervention. Syria, we might be moving towards NATO military intervention. Yemen, everyone's been playing around with different sides, GCC, US, Saudi Arabia, you name it. What else do we have? So the only two kind of purely peaceful indigenous models we have are Egypt and Tunisia, and they happened more than a year ago. What's the lesson here? It's that sometimes you need international factors to tip the balance one way or the other. So when I hear it's not about us, it's about them, it is going to be about us in a lot of these countries, because without us, the struggle for freedom is not going to succeed. It's not going to succeed in Syria. It didn't succeed in Libya without us, and it probably won't succeed in a place like Bahrain, so on. And the list goes on. Now, this presents an opportunity, and as much anti-Americanism as there is, what you find that's very interesting, that in their time of need, the rebels, the revolutionaries, the protesters, in a place like Libya or Syria, they don't look east to Russia or China with all this talk of American decline and all that. No. In their time of need, they're pleading for Western powers to intervene. We saw that in Libya first, where literally you had NTC officials pleading, in some cases, you know, even tearing up, saying, where, how come the U.S. isn't doing more? Where is the world? And if we go to Syria, the SNC formally endorsed military intervention on December 19th. The FSA has been for foreign military intervention since day one. The broader protest movement on the ground, each Friday, they name their Friday and they give it some theme. In October, they called one of their Fridays No-Fly Zone Friday. So all of the major strands of the Syrian opposition, as much as they may dislike America, they still look to America and the West in general, Europe and whoever else, for moral leadership. And I think we can't lose sight of that. I think that's been one of the very interesting undercurrents of the past year. So I think that in theory, the Arab Spring could have been, or maybe still could be, I guess, not sure which tense to use there, could have been an amazing opportunity for the U.S. It could have been an amazing opportunity for the international community, for Europe, to reassert their role, but to play a positive role and to, for lack of a better way to put it, to kind of atone for our sins. And I'm not sure that we're doing that. So let me just, I don't want to go too long, but let me just briefly assess now what the Obama administration in particular has done. I think this can kind of extend to the U.S. and Europe more generally. Now, I think we've been behind the curve in every single country that has had an uprising. I think in Washington, it's a little bit myopic there, so they think that Obama's done a passable, you know, he's done a passable job. He's done pretty good. He has the right rhetoric, a lot of pro-democracy platitudes, great. But actually, if you look at each country, we were behind the curve in every one. Obama didn't even have a statement on Tunisia until Ben Ali had left the country. So not only were we behind the curve, I mean, we were as behind the curve as you possibly could have been. Egypt, I think what Egyptians would say is that in that 18-day period, we wanted some kind of middle road. We wanted the regime to somehow survive intact. We were pushing Omar Suleiman as someone who could lead the transition. We only gave up on Mubarak at the very end when there wasn't another choice. Libya. Britain and France were for military intervention. And everyone was saying, where's the U.S. on this? It was only in the last 6 days, around March 14th, give or take a few days, where the U.S. shifted its position and began supporting military intervention. Bahrain, let's not even talk about Bahrain disaster. The list goes on. So it's Syria. Yeah, so you get the message. So I think we're at a point now, and if you look at the countries where the dog hasn't barked, we still support autocratic regimes in the region. We still fund them. We still give them arms. Morocco, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE. So where there has been change, we've tried to move a little bit, but let's not forget that there's other countries that get less attention, and we haven't fundamentally reassessed our policy in those countries. Now, so a couple policy options to consider. First of all, I think there has to be a grand strategy that we do have to at least acknowledge that now is the time to fundamentally reassess our policy in the Middle East. And I think once you make that decision and that commitment, there are a set of policy options that flow from that. Now, I think a very basic one is aid conditionality. In the countries that we give billions of dollars to, and I mean, Egypt, Jordan is the second largest per capita recipient of U.S. aid. Morocco gets about $800 million a year now. Part of it's from an MCC compact. These are countries where we do have leverage because we are the primary donors. Now, as a principle, we should not give additional assistance to countries unless they're willing to meet a set of explicit measurable benchmarks on political reform. That has to be a principle. Now, there is already some talk. I mean, there is a fund that's about $770 million that the U.S. is trying to come up with that will try to incentivize this, but it also has to have enough money. And what I've been an advocate of is a region-wide reform endowment. It's got to be at least something like $5 to $10 billion to cover the region. I mean, anything less than a billion is quite frankly embarrassing. And no one's going to take that seriously. I mean, for aid to have leverage, there has to be enough of it. And we can't cancel each other out. The countries that are on board with this idea have to coordinate their aid. So the U.S., the European countries, Turkey, emerging democracies like Brazil, Indonesia, but also even the GCC countries, and they can all contribute to this fund. There was some talk about that in the context of the Deauville Partnership. I think that's an idea that we have to take seriously. Now, a couple of minutes? Okay.
A minute or two.
Okay. Now, military intervention. I won't say much about that, but I think we have to acknowledge that there's some countries where military intervention, as much as we want to avoid it, may become necessary. And obviously that was the case in Libya. I think it will become the case in Syria. There's something to be said for exhausting all diplomatic options, and we are doing precisely that. I think Kofi Annan's mission is the last-ditch effort. And if that fails, which we hope it won't, but it likely will, then there are no clear options, at least as far as I'm concerned. So I think we also, as an international community, have to have a serious conversation about the role of military force in supporting democracy abroad, because Syria probably won't be the last time. And let me just close by saying something about the problem of leverage, and I should just briefly mention what's happening in Egypt, because I know that's probably on some of your minds going forward. I think one problem the Obama administration has had is that it's not great on leverage. President Obama hasn't been very effective at using leverage in the Middle East. So what that means is people don't take our threats seriously. So when we threatened to withhold aid in Egypt, Egypt's military didn't take us seriously. And they were right, because we've now decided to resume aid, even though the NGO crisis hasn't been resolved. Egypt is waging a war on civil society, but we back down. On Israel, we back down pretty much every other month or more. That's pretty clear. And the how we kind of raised a high bar and the settlement freeze, and we kept on backing down, that sends a very clear message. On Syria, I don't think Assad takes the international community seriously or the U.S. seriously, because he knows that we're not seriously considering military intervention yet. Bahrain, even if we put the relocation of the Fifth Fleet on the table, the Bahrainis know very well that the Obama administration is not actually going to do that. So in these four examples, our leverage is ineffective because the regimes don't think we're going to follow through on our threats. So we have to reestablish the idea of credible threats, whether through military or non-military options. And finally, I think that there's, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in the question and answer, there's an argument that we shouldn't do more, and this kind of interventionist approach that I'm offering is actually counterproductive because people don't like us and there's a lot of anti-Americanism. But I think that's a vicious circle. One of the reasons people don't like us, and perhaps the primary one in the Arab world along with Israel-Palestine, is the lack of our refusal to support democracy in a consistent, serious way over decades. If we want to change that, we have to start somewhere. And I think the time to start that is now. That's not going to shift opinion in 2 years or three. It's going to take time. And that's why it has to be consistent, and it has to be well thought out, but it has to start now. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean. So I think this has been tremendously useful in giving us a way of thinking about the problem. And I think, Bruce gave us a sort of structural sense, Sarah an economic sense, Shadi a political sense. But I want to bring this down to something more specific. So I'd like to give all of you a not very hypothetical, and have you answer it for me. So let's suppose that in Egypt, the presidential election goes forward, the constitutional process goes forward, sometime later this summer, there's a new president, there's a constitution, the military withdraws from power. Nevertheless, Egypt is still what it is. The nationalism, the hostility to the U.S., suspicion about the West, and so forth. So in that real world, where that transition is happening with those limitations, let's talk about what, in fact, can be done. So, Bruce, if we start with you, why don't you just go ahead and take a shot at that?
I'm going to answer politically more than operationally. Sorry, I was leaning in here. I'm going to answer politically more than operationally. I agree with quite a lot of what Shadi said at the end, except that in a lot of places I would try to substitute a broader set of actors than U.S. And I think that one of the things that the United States frequently does wrong is it fails to understand the tactical advantage of working through multilateral institutions or working through multilateral coalitions. So the investment fund, and you talked about a kind of broader regional mechanism. I guess I have question marks about why it is the Gulf is going to pay into a mechanism to support democracy in the Levant, right? This is a question mark about that. But on the other hand, I have no hesitation, that some people do have, in seeking Chinese support for that transition fund or other actors who are willing to pay in to support economic opportunities in the Gulf. I don't think that China investing through a multilateral fund of that type would lead to sort of people looking to Beijing for some of this kind of something. So what I'm trying to say is I think that a number of the things that can be done to support transition in a place like Egypt don't have to carry a U.S. face. In fact, can be perhaps more productive if they don't carry a U.S. base, even though the United States should surely participate and often lead in the construction of those frameworks. So I would, in that real-world situation, I think the United States should be very active in driving investments to Egypt, but not necessarily in the lead. This is why I have to say, in the political debate around Libya, there became this moment when the administration was sort of pummeled from all sides by having an anonymous person, who was probably Ben Rhodes, describe the strategy as leading from behind. Whatever the politics of that phrase, it seems to me that leading from behind is exactly the right strategy, at least visibly from behind, right? It's not like the United States was invisible in Libya. The United States was present and critical, but it was not in the front, and it was a broader coalition of action, including through the Council. And that seems to me to be politically exactly right for a lot of what happens now. The United States is a necessary actor here, and in the kind of Egyptian context you're talking about, the United States will play important roles. By the way, I think that, I mean, it's worth just saying for the historical record that in the Egyptian transition, I think you alluded to this when you said there was an international component to even the Egyptian transition. I think the United States actually played an important role in using its leverage over the Egyptian army and keeping them out of Tahrir Square in the first days and sort of, you know, making very clear to the Egyptian army that any crackdown would carry real consequences. And I think you'll see similar roles the United States can play even in an Egyptian context like the one you just discussed with the army. But it doesn't have to be, and I think in many cases it's counterproductive for the United States to be the front face, and we can construct multilateral frameworks here that give us many more tools for action, many more voices for action, and we can use those nimbly.
So, Sarah, the SG appoints you special representative for Egypt. So you talked about the kind of quick wins that have been created elsewhere, and so you have the opportunity to create quick wins in Egypt. So one question I have is, okay, what would that mean in the Egyptian context? And then Shani talked about this big number. You said there's a danger of pouring too much money into these places. How do you solve that problem?
So I'm going to answer that again by looking at what has actually been done in other countries.
But try to bring, do try as much as possible to think about what can be done in a place like Egypt.
But it's useful also to see what actually has worked or hasn't. For any country going through the kind of political transition that you described, there should also be a moment at which it's possible for that society to come together around a broader reform plan that includes political, but also includes economic and social issues in it. It may also include reform of the security or justice institutions. It's crucially important, I think, in those moments that the signals that the international community gives about participation are not uniquely focused on elections, which has tended in the past to be far too much our sole benchmark of whether a transition is successful, and more on whether there are mechanisms in place to express what people want as their priorities in those broader areas. So I would ideally want to see a process where there is an opportunity for Egyptian society to input to what they see as the most important priorities. If we look at other countries, that can occur in different areas. So people obviously can feel that it's very important to have an opportunity to have access to jobs, if this has been one of their practical constraints. They can also feel, and they have in many countries, that taking away some of the sources of corruption or abuse that were in their daily lives, in terms of the behavior of police forces, for instance, is actually one of their first priorities.
And what can outsiders take that as an example? Okay, there you are, you're running a show in Egypt. This is a deep-seated, long-standing problem. What do outsiders do in order to, for example, make police forces less corrupt?
So, again, you need a process inside the country in which people have the opportunity to input those priorities. So I just don't think it is possible for outsiders to come in and say, this is what the priority should be.
How do outsiders help with that?
I think there's a big difference relating also to what Shadi said. When there is a reform plan that has been set within the country and the government, in discussion with its population, has agreed to a set of actions, to use that reform plan as part of the basis for international assistance, I think, can be very useful. It can be a way of giving traction to reformers. It can be a way of keeping things on track. To come in from outside with conditionality that sets the reform plan from outside, I think, is not.
What about the kind of sticks that Shadi was talking about, which you might have to use in a case like Egypt, where you've got a military government which is still, from the background, calling the shots or whatever? mistake.
But again, the difference that I'm making is between having a plan and a set of commitments that were designed from inside the country and then using international assistance to support that plan versus coming in with a preset of ideas about in which sequence things should be done. And let me give an example of that in terms of some of the difficulties that countries face when they go through this. You will have a whole set of different aspirations for quick change. You will have limitations on resources and what can be achieved in the first 6 months or 1 year or 2 years. Probably won't be possible to do everything. And you will have some choices about what is done first. So I used, for instance, some of the experiences in Chile and Indonesia in introducing. Those two countries follow very different routes in terms of reform of the military, and yet both countries have gone through a lot of reform. Indonesia took an angle which very much looked at the links between economic activities, the role of the military in the economy. Chile took a tack which very much looked at justice within the military, accountability for past abuses. And actually both countries postponed action on some of the other areas. I don't think either of those paths were necessarily wrong. They had to be decided from within the country in terms of what was most realistic. So my basic answer to this is support a reform plan, but support one that was set with voice from inside the country, and then provide financing that goes across a range of institutions. So another risk here from the international community is that after a positive change, all the financing moves to government programs with very little financing for civil society activities. That doesn't work. It also doesn't work, though, to be pouring so much money through very new civil society organisations that you, in effect, put them in a position where they can be accused of being less responsible to their own people and more responsible to external
groups. So, Shadi, so Sarah as SRSG was clearly going to work consensually with the Egyptian regime, whatever, with the new Egyptian government. But it sounds like you, as let's say, U.S. ambassador to Egypt, might wield both a bigger carrot and also a bigger stick. So again, put yourself in this situation and think, what is it that you would like state outsiders, as opposed to multinational outsiders, to do in an ambiguous situation like Egypt may well soon become?
Well, I'm not opposed to the idea of coming up with benchmarks and consultation with various political forces in Egypt. But that doesn't mean that people who aren't fully committed to reform should be allowed to hinder the process. And if you recall, in the Bush administration's broader Middle East initiative, there was an effort to coordinate with existing regimes, and a lot of the proposals got watered down for precisely that reason. There's things that the international community should not compromise on, and that will differ from country to country. I think one way to kind of build consensus around shared goals is to deepen our engagement with certain political actors in Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be the dominant force in Egyptian politics for the foreseeable future. We have to have a serious strategic dialogue with them and deepen our engagement as much as possible. And this is another example of where we've been behind the curve. I mean, we should have been doing that 5 or 6 years ago. We waited until after the Arab Spring to start. It's unfortunate, but I think now the task before us is to build a relationship of trust and confidence over time with the Muslim Brotherhood, with ultra-conservative Salafi parties. We have to get over our fear of Islamists coming to power. And what's encouraging about the Brotherhood in Egypt is that they're more potentially pro-American than we think. And I've been meeting with Brotherhood officials on a regular basis since, I guess, 2005. And first of all, I've heard more Bush nostalgia from Muslim Brotherhood officials in private than pretty much anyone else. And actually, there's a lot of reform. I mean, that's a whole different story, the sources of Bush nostalgia and the subsequent disappointment with the Obama administration. Anyway, the point there is groups like the Brotherhood are open to deeper engagement with the U.S. They're instinctively free market. They do want the U.S. to support their transitions with aid, investment, and loans. And there's a meeting of interest there. So I think that's an area that we have to take very seriously, and we have to be creative about it too, and think about how we can build those relationships, not just in Egypt, but also Libya, when the Syrian Brotherhood eventually comes to power in Syria, which presumably they will at some point. So we also have to think ahead.
Bruce, you were taking a lot of notes there. Do you want to respond to something that either Shadi said, Sarah said, or that you yourself said?
No, it's just two sort of detailed additional thoughts. I mean, on Shadi's last point, it seems to me that one of the other things that's happened recently, which we need to take advantage of, and I don't know which we I'm referring to here, is that Hamas has moved back to the Muslim Brotherhood camp. Right? And Hamas always was in the Muslim Brotherhood camp after 9/11 in Iraq, sort of pushed into the Damascus camp and has moved back. And that matters in terms of the politics of what happens. It's part of what makes me think about the kind of need to be less conservative than a kind of blind support to the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian side of that issue. I think there are important things that are happening there. This is a very sort of technical point, but on building on the things that Sarah was saying, but also on Shadi's point about benchmarks, if we accept that some variation of the rule of law theme, including the economic justice theme, etc., is part of what we should be talking about, it's also possible to measure that, and it's possible to measure that consistently over time. And I think that one of the things we should be doing right now is investing in measurements of progress against a series of benchmarks region-wide that can be kind of published regularly as a source of pressure, which is, in a sense, not about whether we're for or against this regime or not, but establishing some sort of ground, some normatively grounded framework for thinking about which direction we're moving. And I would actually even make a very bizarre proposal coming from me that get grounded in ESCLA. I say that that's bizarre because normally I think that the UN's regional economic institutions are a complete waste of time. It so happens that ESCLA right now is headed by Rima Khalafunadi, who was the intellectual sort of author of the Arab Human Development Report and a very credible actor, I think, on these issues in the region. So sort of building up the capacity of her and of that institution in a sort of depoliticized way almost to report on steady progress or not against a series of benchmarks of transition, I think, would be helpful in giving a sort of a non-cherry-picking, non-biased platform for actors to push a range of actors, both governmental and non-governmental, on transition.
Well, Sarah, if I could ask you a question. Conditionality, benchmarks, these are not forms of coercion, but they are forms of things that are seen as restrictions on the capacity of the state to make its own priorities and so forth, its own development decisions. Is that necessary in order to ensure that the kind of assistance we're talking about is going to be well used? Or if you're that SRSG in Egypt, are you going to find that makes your life impossible because that will create a kind of nationalist backlash?
I think the crucial thing here is where the benchmarks come from. And I'm glad you asked me because I think perhaps we misunderstood in my answer to the last question the difference I was making. I actually think that it's perfectly acceptable if you have a plan that has been developed with participation from the population of the country and the government then breaches the commitments in that plan to condition assistance on the fact that the plan has been carried forward or not. That's a form of conditionality, right? It means that we're not just providing assistance whatever happens, we're providing assistance based on some agreed commitments. I think that is very different, though, from going in with an idea, which is essentially an outsider's idea, of what the benchmarks of a transition should be, and then saying to a country, we will punish you or reward you, depending on whether you meet our benchmarks of the transition. So just to summarize that in terms, I would say that's if you think of the structural adjustment programs of the 1980s, for instance, I would not like to see political structural adjustment programs that take one Washington consensus view of what every country does and penalizes countries based on whether they've achieved it or not. I do think it would be a good thing to see a process for the population of each of the countries concerned to set what they want to be the key changes and then have international assistance support that.
First of all, I apologize for the heat. It's really warm in here. I'm very sorry, but I can't do anything about it. Let me pose one other hypothetical, and then we're going to throw it open to the audience. So Egypt is an example of what we're imagining is an essentially permissive environment, where a democratic-like government has taken over. Let's talk about a possible not-permissive environment, not an extreme one like Syria. Let's take the example of Bahrain, which a couple of you mentioned. So in a case like that, where there has not been a transition, and indeed the state has successfully pushed back against reformist forces. And yet, for example, the United States clearly has, as Shadi said, a lot of leverage there. Other actors may have leverage there. It's not clear how much can be done. So let's talk about what it is that in Bahrain or one of the other not-so-permissive environments outsiders can do. So let me start with you, Shadi, because you raised that yourself, and you obviously think the Obama administration policy there has been wrong.
Bahrain's a tough one. I don't think there's any great resolution to it, in part because Saudi Arabia is the most influential actor there, and they'll do whatever it takes to keep that regime in power. That said, I do believe the Fifth Fleet is a major point of leverage that the U.S. has, but also other forms of military support and assistance, and also the U.K. has a strong military relationship with the Bahraini regime as well. Ideally, this threat to relocate the Fifth Fleet would not be followed through on. If it was credible, I think it would force the Bahrainis to really reconsider certain things. Because for them, it's a kind of security umbrella. It's not something that they want to lose. It's a relationship that they really value. Of course, if they don't take it seriously, then at some point you have to follow through. And I think that's something that has to be prepared as a contingency plan, and we should ideally be thinking about alternative places in the region to relocate the base. Even if that ultimately hurt our leverage in Bahrain, at least we wouldn't be tarred with supporting the Bahraini regime. If either way the Bahraini regime is going to repress their own people, let's at least show that we're on the right side of that. Because if you take each of these cases on their own, then it may not seem smart, but I think if you take them all together and you take a consistent pro-democracy position in each, over time, that will accrue to the U.S. or the U.K.'s, or whoever it is, to their credibility
so,
on this particular issue.
You would say even if it didn't work, and therefore you presumably damaged seriously your relationship with the Bahraini regime, it's still worth doing because of the kind of atmospheric gains throughout the region where you are seen as on the good side.
Yeah, if you're willing to see it through, if you're going to just do it in some countries and not others, it's obviously not going to work. And if I'm being realistic, there's no way this is ever going to happen. I mean, that's just not the way U.S. governments are oriented. And if I was in government, I'd never be saying what I'm saying now. But I think in an ideally, that's the kind of that's the sort of thing that will fundamentally change U.S. policy in the region, and over time would be in our long-term interest. The question is, how much are you willing to damage your short-term interests in the pursuit of more longer-term gains? And the way politicians are oriented, obviously, they're not going to be thinking about 40 years from now. So it takes a level of boldness and creativity from the U.S. government, and that's not something that most administrations have been known for. I'd say the only bold administration in recent memory in the U.S. on foreign policy in the Middle East was the Bush administration, but that was also very destructive. So, I mean, how much boldness do you really want?
Bruce, what do you think about that?
I guess my sense, one of the reasons I think that it's important, despite everything I said about the kind of variation, to work regionally and to work against some kind of set of normative standards, is that if you can begin to articulate what those are, measure them in an inclusive way, and set out where you are and you are not seeing transformation, it's going to become increasingly clear, not that it's really hard to figure this out, that you're not seeing it in Bahrain, you're not seeing it in Saudi, etc. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. And frankly, we don't want it to happen overnight because the economic consequences of it happening overnight are extremely difficult for us or anybody else to take in terms of the price of oil. So, I mean, I would be leery of the threat to move the Fifth Fleet because we won't. I know you said that. The U.S. government wouldn't actually do it. I'm leery of it, and I think that the...
Assuming you shouldn't threaten it at all if you're not going to do it.
Indeed. And so I think that there you're really more in a space, which we've been in other places. Think about the way the United States changed its relationship with Indonesia over time, for example, from a kind of pretty full-throated backing of Suharto and lots of aid to the army, etc., to using that leverage to shift their position in a number of key things. It seems to me that that's more of the space we have to Bahrain and in Saudi, of making the argument to them that their regimes have a shelf life if they're not. And I think this is as much, in fact, it's more Saudi. I'd be less focused on Bahrain and more focused on Saudi because I see no real probably be more focused on Saudi and talking to the Saudis about how it is that they're going to survive the next transition, which will come. It won't come immediately, but it will come. And so a kind of more medium-term engagement with the Saudis on what a pathway towards some degree of transformation looks like seems to me a more realistic way of approaching this. It's not that I disagree with what you just said in sort of moral terms. I can't see the sources of genuine leverage over Bahrain to make this happen.
Sarah, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Just I agree with the regional norm-setting approach. I think one of the few other things you can do when a situation is deteriorating is try to do the analysis to demonstrate to a government what it is they are losing through these actions, which in some other cases has worked when there has been a real economic loss, for example. This also comes back to the earlier point that I made about helping with transitions at the scale needed, that I think in the region there will be a real problem if transitions like Tunisia are seen to falter economically, while countries that are not reforming are not seeming to suffer very much cost. That comparison is not a very good one for the sake of reform. So it also is a real reason to be investing in the countries that have made progress to make sure that the difference can be.
All right, well, thank you very much. So I know Sarah has to leave in a few minutes because there's a UN vote. And so I'd like to throw it open to questions, and especially if anybody has a question for Sarah so that we can get it to her before she has to go. So if there are any questions out there, please raise your hand. And I guess we have a microphone here which we can bring over to you. And please identify yourself, by the way.
Surely. My name is Azza Karam, and I serve as a staff member of the United Nations Population Fund. I just wanted to share a couple of comments, really. First of all, thank you all for very thought-provoking presentations. I think there's a certain dissonance in what we've heard, precisely because outsiders have not been accurately defined. We're confusing different terms. We're speaking about the U.S. government. We're speaking about multilateral organizations like the United Nations. yes, we're going to be putting down a painting very soon. I think it's important for us to distinguish between exactly who we mean. Those of us who work in the United Nations system are not necessarily terribly comfortable being labeled as outsiders, especially when we come from the region, we work on the region, and we're all about the region. You mentioned Bruce Rima Khalaf. She was serving as the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations Development Program. She's now serving as Under Secretary General in ESQA. I'm not sure she'd be comfortable being acknowledged as an outsider. And there are many like her. So therefore, I think we need to be a little bit more nuanced when we speak of the UN, especially since we've lost colleagues in the region who were killed as a result of being thought as outsiders, incorrectly so. So I think that is a very important nuance. I'm not sure about the dogs and the barking, but you might want to clarify that because it's somewhat culturally sensitive for the region. The issue, if you don't mind my raising or flagging of moral leadership and shedding, Muslim Brotherhood has been in negotiations with the American administrations over many, many, many
there
haven't years.
Been formal contact since the early 1990s.
Define formal. The fact of the matter is there have been many contacts over the years, and I think the nature of that is going to be very critical to keep in mind. Again, just another nuance. And I think given that there are those kinds of connections, the extent to which we can accurately say that there isn't any significant communication with the Brotherhood and the rise that is taking place across the regions, we might want to revisit that. There's lots more I'd like to add, but
yeah,
I also
want to make sure everybody else has a chance. Thank you. Well, we're fine. We'll take a few others. So, yes, in the back there.
Good afternoon. My name is Kai Stabel. I'm also with the United Nations Development Program. My question is just related to, if we're looking at how we can nurture democracies or democratic tendencies, throughout the discussion today, the role of women's empowerment and gender equality has not really been addressed. And I'm wondering, is it because it's mainstreamed and thus not spoken of? Or are we going to see, you know, you're talking about initially also about how Libya is a potentially positive development. No one's really willing to push Libya too hard on sort of avoiding what Egypt did, where you end up with less than 2% women. When you're going to write a constitution. So I just wanted to hear if you have any ideas on how we can ensure that women are more part of the constitutional.
Anyone else? Yes, up in the front here.
Yes,
wait for the microphone, please.
great discussion. Thank you so much.
You want to identify yourself?
Oh, yes. My name is Trish Hsu, and I'm a freelance journalist at UNCA. And I guess I'd like to ask Shai, or whoever can answer, regarding the unfinished business as far as the Arab Spring. It seemed like the first time that we heard the term Arab Spring was in 2003, and then, you know, there's been, it stopped and started. But specifically, could you comment on the role of the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon in the Arab Spring?
All right, let's just stop at those three, and then we'll take some others. So either one of you gentlemen, please begin.
On the UN not being outsiders,
yeah.
Ish. I think if you look at the, I've actually been very struck at how few Arabs there are in senior positions at the UN and Ban Ki-moon's cabinet, how little effort there has been over the last several years to reach out to Arab civil society. It is important that Rima's been put into ESPO now, but that was late. So I've actually been struck more by the opposite, that by comparison to an earlier period where there was quite a lot of presence of the UN in the Arab world and vice versa, I think rather less so over the last year. Now, I'm sure there are individual agencies where that's not true. Certainly at the political level, I think Ban Ki-moon has been pretty cut off from the Arab world and certainly from sources of opposition. So I understand the point you're making, and it's an important one, but I would put it with some caution. Women's empowerment is a very important point. It was one of the three major deficits that Rima talked about in the Arab Human Development Report: knowledge, democratic institutions, and women empowerment were the three. And I think that actually one of the better things that the UN has done is to be talking about that issue, including through the voice of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. I think there, it's like many of these issues, human rights issues and empowerment issues, the challenge, because you referenced the kind of slow pace in Libya, the challenge is a timing one, right? I mean, if we have the sense that sort of all human rights advances will be made over, you know, a very short period of time, well, then I think we're setting up failure. And when we push too hard, too quickly, too far, a kind of broad sweep of transitions, it simply sets up failure. Then I think that Sarah's point is the right one. It's the question of who is involved in that discussion of priorities. And we can do some things from the outside to encourage governments and other actors to make sure that women are involved in that discussion. But I think it's oversimplified to think that we're going to see sort of dramatic transformations on that or any other sort of set of human rights issues in a very short period of time. And it goes back to something that Jim started with. You know, we have to have a kind of medium-term framework here. I'm not saying we sit back and wait for things for 15 years, but it's problematic in both political and narrative terms, but more importantly, sort of how we act, to be reaching judgments on the basis of, well, 6 months in or 1 year in. I mean, these are going to be transitions that take 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, and we have to have that sense of time frame and of continuing to push issues through over that period.
Okay, on the issue of contacts with the Brotherhood, first of all, there were no official formal contacts between the U.S. and the Brotherhood since about 1993. There were low-level bump-ins, let's call them. So essentially the way the U.S. would do it is they would accidentally bump into a Muslim Brotherhood member in, like, the elevator at someone's house. It was pretty absurd. And you would have, and I worked on some Track 2 stuff where we tried to get U.S. officials with Brotherhood people. It was pretty challenging. And anyway, that's a whole different story. I don't believe in ad hoc engagement where you just meet with a Brotherhood official once every couple months, you say hi and exchange pleasantries. I'm talking about real strategic engagement, a real partnership, and I think actually the rise of Sunni Islamists throughout the region could actually be quite good for the U.S. I mean, first of all, they don't like Iran so much. There's actually surprisingly a set of common interests that I think the U.S. shares with Sunni Islamists. And there is a whole Sunni Islamist bloc: Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, soon Syria, we hope. So there is this emerging bloc, and I think that presents a real strategic opportunity for the U.S., not just talking to them, but engaging in a very serious way, to the extent that there's mutual interest there, an exchange of interests. We offer, let's call them, concessions to the Brotherhood on certain things.
They offer concessions to us, presumably on Israel. Anyway, that's a different conversation. As for gender equality, I don't want to be too provocative on this, but so let me just think about how I want to put this.
Blurt out the first that comes into your head.
Yeah, sure. Well, I have an ideological bias because I'm a small D Democrat. I put more emphasis on democracy over liberalism. I'm a liberal in the U.S., but I don't think that as an American I have the right to impose liberalism on the Arab world. I think democracy is about the right to make the wrong choice, and I think Arabs have every right to be a liberal, as long as they're not violating core constitutional aspects. So yes, we have to support equality before the law, but if we're, women's empowerment programs and things like that, I worry that they're misguided because they're not really in line with the cultural milieu of where the Arab world is now. And all the polling suggests is that there is really no constituency in a place like Egypt for women's rights or gender equality as we Americans conceive it. That's just unfortunate.
So, Shadi, would that apply to Afghanistan as well, where men want to have the right to beat their wives under the right circumstances?
Well, that would... So, you would have to have certain things enshrined in the Constitution that could be non-negotiable, but I think beyond that low bar... I think we should be careful about how far we go. I don't like it. I wish we could do more, but I just don't know how productive those efforts are. I think the emphasis for now at least should be on democracy promotion, not on getting too much into this issue of values that may not be seen as universal. Lastly, on the Cedar Revolution, I'm not...
I'm going to come to you, don't worry, yes.
Yeah.
You want to say one more thing about the Cedar Revolution?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on Lebanon, but I think that was an important event. Unfortunately, I think it's been rolled back quite a bit. But yes, I mean, 2004, 2005, they were calling that the Arab Spring. I was living in Jordan at the time. There was very much a sense that if you took the rise of protest movements in several countries, including Lebanon, there was a sense of forward movement. So yeah, this is actually the second Arab Spring, as it turns out.
You want to say one thing, or should we? Okay, just if we have time for a few more questions. Yes, right up here in the front, and then I know there was one right back in the back, which will come to in a second.
Well, I'm Pania Nazari from the Center on International Cooperation. And just on the points raised right now, I have a couple of responses and questions. Very quick. First, on the international community supporting Sunnis, how is that good for the region? There are divisions, but a lot of countries have both Sunnis and Shiites. It might be good on the point of Iran, but it is going to cause more divergence and separations among Muslim people. Sharpening that, supporting one particular group of Muslims, although I am Sunni myself, but I don't see how is that helping the region. And second, on the point of women, I think democracy for women and for minorities in those regions is extremely important. And I am from Afghanistan, and for the women up there, the agendas to really support and empower Afghan women has been one of the big successes of the past decade in the U.S.'s involvement in the country. And that should be preserved and continued. So.
I know there was a question back there. Maybe if you stood up, it would be helpful.
I'm Lee O'Brien, Department of Political Affairs. I just wanted to sort of ask Bruce, I very much agree with his points for the issues of the challenge of how to be normative and how to be consistent. In my many years working on the Middle East in the UN, I have to say that I think we all, UNDP, EPA, everyone, have failed massively in that respect. It is certainly one of the regions and the positioning
So both you guys have about 2 minutes. Either one of you can start.
Okay. I think people may have misunderstood my comments on the women. Let me just clarify this issue of the situation of women in the region. I'm simply making a descriptive statement about where things are at now. The fact of the matter is that in a place like Egypt, 75% of Egyptians voted for parties that do not share American notions of gender equality. This is simply a fact. Now, we can deny it or ignore it. That's just the way that it is. And, you know, there was a YouGov poll for March, and this is one of many, where only 18% of Egyptian respondents said they believe that a woman should be president or can be president. That's where we're at. I wish it was different. It'll take time, but it has to come from within the culture, and it's going to be gradual. It's not something that you can impose. And I think gender quotas in some cases may be positive, but ultimately you can't force people to have certain views on gender equality. That's all I'm trying to say. And I do think the more democracy you have in the Arab world, it's not going to be great for women's rights in the short term, and we've already seen that. It's become very clear in a number of countries. So there is a tension, and there will be a tension for the foreseeable future between liberalism and democracy. And I think at some point, you have to decide which you prioritize more. And that's a choice that all of us have to make. Now, as for supporting Sunni Islamists, I'm not saying that we should support them because they're Sunni. I'm saying that these are groups that have been elected through the democratic process in a number of countries. They have popular legitimacy. And my basic approach is that we should engage more with actors that have popular legitimacy and have been elected by the people. Because we did the opposite for 50 years. Whether they're Shia or Sunni, that's not the key issue. It just happens to be the case that in most of these countries, the most popular Islamist parties are Sunni.
On this latter point, I mean, I have the same view as Shadi on the Sunni question. It's not why we engage, but the fact that there are, you know, in this context, against a long and negative history, you have to find points of commonality, right? And so there are some, but I wish, you don't focus on the Sunni element, you focus on points of commonality. On the kind of women's rights versus democracy, if you want to kind of just torture yourself, you should Google the interview that was done with Tony Blair and Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, where Ellen Sirleaf Johnson is asked about gay rights in Liberia and gives the most truculent, conservative, hideous answer, and Tony Blair is sitting there looking desperately embarrassed as a kind of governance advisor to the Liberian transition. So the tensions are real. On Lee's point, one of the things that I think we have to, and it's unfortunate that our friend Ryuti left the room already, one of the things we should confront the development system with is that after the Human Development Report, the UN Human Development Report, Arab Human Development Report in 2002, I don't think it's just that the development system was sovereigntist. I think they sucked up to the regimes as a strategy, right? Hired from within the regimes, got close to the regimes as a way to curry favor on the theory that that would give them influence, which it didn't in the slightest. I think that the experience and the position of the development community in the Arab world over the past decade has been atrocious. And nobody talks about it, but I think we need to kind of excavate that reality, that the position of the development community as a matter of national ownership has been to suck up to regimes, pretty much no matter what they do. And I think we need to focus on that as a part of the challenge. Now, if I look at the UN politically, I think there is at least a slightly different storyline. Okay, I mean, I'm really grasping for straws, but you can connect the dots between the Arab Human Development Report, speeches that Annan made at the OIC and the Arab League, calling for democratic reforms when nobody else was, before Bush, before anything else, right? I think, I mean, you know, many of you in the room know what I think about Ban Ki-moon, but I think that the Arab Spring has been a better Ban Ki-moon than much of what came before in terms of where he's been positioned. I'm not saying that he is as far out as he should be on things like Saudi and Bahrain, but he's been better than one might have anticipated on Egypt, on Syria, on Libya, etc. So the point here is I think that somebody's got to articulate a normative framework. For the reasons I was talking about before, I don't think it works if it's the United States or the West. I think that the UN, of course, is powerfully motivated by Western values and has powerful Western patrons, etc., but is broader than that. Articulating that framework, there is some credibility to that. It's not as tenuous as it might have been absent those sort of data points that I spelled out. And I'm not here looking at the Council. I'm looking at the SG. I'm calling for the SG to articulate this, drawing on the kinds of voices we were talking about before, Rima and others, Brahimia, there are people around to draw on, because it gives a point of reference against which we can apply pressure that is not just this kind of cherry-picking, we like you now, we don't like you now, etc., which is what we're doing at this stage, and kind of have some normative grounding. I don't think it's impossible to achieve. There is enough of a track record for it to be credible if you just look in the narrative sense. It's absolutely true what you said about the inconsistency, and as I said, I think it's worse than that when you look at development agencies.
Well, thank you all so much. Thank you for sitting through the blazing heat, and you were an excellent audience.